Welcome, folks. Welcome to Vegetarian Stew, a radio program to stir up community awareness of our food choices and how these food choices affect our daily lives, our health, the lives of animals, and our environment. Vegetarian Stew likes to stir together spicy ideas with a dash of common sense and a pinch of creative thinking. We hope that this program simmers in your mind and that you take in some new ideas about food and live more consciously, creatively, and compassionately. We'd like to remind our radio audience that the views expressed during the program are the views of the presenter and not necessarily those of KAFM or its affiliates. Today at the station, as usual, we've got Marion and Joe and me, Carol. Folks, hi. And let me ask the head chef today, Joe, what's cooking?
Well, let me get my hat on here. Today we have as our guest Mike Hudak, Ph.D., a grazing reform activist and author of Western Turf Wars, The Politics of Western Public Lands Ranching.
Hello, Mike. You there?
Mike is the vice chair of the Sierra Club National Grazing Committee and the director of Public Lands Without Livestock. Mike, welcome to Vegetarian Stew.
Thank you.
What is the, let's get right into our questions here, Mike. What is the connection between a vegetarian diet and ranching on public lands?
Certainly, if there were no demand for beef, there wouldn't be any need to raise cattle on public lands or anywhere else. And in my view, that would be a good thing. But there's another sort of answer to that question. And that is that, in my view, vegetarians are in general better suited than many people even who call themselves environmentalists to become grassroots activists opposing public lands ranching. And I'd say the reason for that is that, unlike some environmentalists, vegetarians can operate outside the realm of environmental politics and not get bogged down in weighing considerations of whether ranching, for example, is preferable to coal bed methane extraction, or whether one should support wilderness designation that provides cow-free wilderness but then opens wilderness study areas to ranching. These are the kinds of trade-offs that environmentalists argue over all the time. But in my view, vegetarians should unequivocally oppose the raising of animals for human consumption, and therefore they should oppose ranching on public land, period. And yet I don't see a lot of activity of that sort from vegetarians. And I think that's a major deficiency in our overall effort to end public lands ranching. And I can just give you a brief overview of what I do see happening in public lands ranching activism at this time. Most of the opposition comes from professional activists who work at Western regional organizations like Western Watersheds Project, Forest Guardians, Oregon Natural Desert Association, and some others. And these organizations confront the ranching industry primarily in the courts. Actually, these lawsuits are brought against the management agencies like the Forest Service and the BLM, not against individual ranchers. And these organizations have been pretty effective at winning lawsuits that have actually resulted in reducing the number of cattle on allotments or shortening the grazing season or even sometimes closing an allotment. So that's one major type of activity that's going on. Then there are some grassroots activists in the West, but for the most part, I would say that they don't engage in what I'd call public advocacy or public education. They're instead drawn into agency-sanctioned activities. And by that I mean things like they seek membership on resource advisory councils that the BLM has, or maybe they'll submit comments on a proposed allotment management plan, or they may attend public meetings and things like that. But in the end, I don't really see that kind of activity as really moving us forward in any significant way, unless after all of their comments and whatever, these people are actually willing to sue the agencies in much the same way that the organizations are.
Can you tell us why vegetarians and folks in general, why we should care about ranching on public lands?
Sure. Let me give you a little bit of history. The ranching has been going on, of course, in the West for a long time. It started in parts of the Southwest already in the early 1600s by Spanish colonists. And at that time, though, it wasn't really a big business. It was just done for local consumption, and the impacts weren't all that great. But then, about the middle of the 19th century, it did turn into a big business because you had railroads being built from the east and west coasts, and, of course, the cattle could be transported to major population centers. And so the amount of ranching increased dramatically. And even though these were public lands in the west that the ranchers were grazing their cattle on, the government was not managing the cattle in any way. And every rancher was really out for himself to get as much forage for his cattle as he could. And so you had what has been sometimes called the tragedy of the commons, where you then have tremendous damage being done because these cattle are overgrazing and there's tremendous soil erosion and soil compaction and so on. And so until the Forest Service was established in the early part of the 20th century and then the passage of the Taylor Grazing Act in 1934, which led to the establishment of the BLM, as I said, you had this tremendous damage being done. When those agencies really came into existence to try to get some control over the grazing and to try to make it sustainable. But even after 100 years of the Forest Service management and about 70 years of BLM management, it's sad to say that the condition really hasn't improved. In fact, there's some, I'd say, considerable evidence that conditions have actually worsened. One statistic I know of it is that there's something like 300 species of wildlife that are estimated to be negatively impacted by the grazing of livestock.
In what way?
Their habitat is degraded in terms of vegetation that these wildlife species use for forage and for nesting.
Oh.
And there's also stream habitat that's been degraded, so you have a lot of aquatic species, fish and amphibians and invertebrates and so on that are impacted because of the degradation of the streams.
There's also direct action, isn't there, also by, for example, what they call wildlife services against the creatures out there.
Right. Well, that's another whole issue in itself. What used to be called animal damage control, that is the elimination of predators and competitors of livestock that ranchers want eliminated. And so, yes, there are direct impacts there. And even those impacts go beyond the target species. Sometimes, even though a particular species is targeted, like coyotes, for instance, other species, red fox, for instance, will be impacted as well because there'll be poison bait left out and non-target species will be killed by it.
Wow.
So those are, I would say, the major reasons. And one thing I would say is that the productivity of the land is really being degraded. And even once the cattle grazing stops, the productivity is going to then take a long time to recover. And the longer the ranching continues, the longer that recovery period will be.
Why is it, do you think, that the public is not more informed or aware about the environmental impacts of livestock grazing? I mean, it sounds like some pretty dramatic bad things are happening because of all this livestock grazing, and yet, you know, I don't think many folks are aware of it.
Well, they're certainly not aware of it much outside of the West. There may be more awareness in the West of it. I hope there is, as a result of some of the work by the regional environmental organizations, like I mentioned. But I would say that a major reason why it isn't better understood is that the ranching has just been so pervasive for so long that it's just part of the landscape.
Right. Okay. It's part of the identity of the West. Yeah.
Yeah. It isn't like a forest clear cut, for instance, where one day you're driving past a patch of virgin old growth forest and the next day it's just totally gone. So the ranching has been there from before anybody who's now living there. And so it's just part of the landscape and the culture. And then another major reason is that the major environmental organizations haven't made this a high-profile and a high-priority issue. And I think a large part of the reason for that is that they do have other high-priority issues, like getting wilderness designated and containing sprawl and opposing oil and gas extraction on public lands. And these campaign strategies that they've developed depend on either not antagonizing ranchers or, in some cases, actually enlisting their support in terms of directly or through public relations.
We'd like to remind our radio audience that we are, this is KAFM Radio, and we are today talking with Mike Hudak, who is the author, and we have the book right here in the studio, and it looks like it's such a great book. It's called Western Turf Wars, The Politics of Public Lands Ranching. And Mike, can you tell us how you came about to write this marvelous book?
Sure. I actually started investigating the issues involved with public lands ranching in 1997. And then over the next several years, I was giving presentations about what I was witnessing. And I'd also written some articles, and I'd installed a website and put up on the internet what I called photo essays.
Excuse me, is this website still in existence, Mike?
Oh, yes, it is. It's MikeHudak.com.
Okay.
And so I had all these things out there, and then by about the fall of 2002, I started to think about doing a project that was different than had been done by anybody up to that point, including me. And in thinking about it, I concluded that one medium that had been underexploited was video, and particularly video in connection with the Internet. And I thought back through these trips that I'd made out there between 97 and 2002, and in addition to actually going out on allotments and seeing the damage that had been done, I also had the opportunity to meet a lot of grassroots activists and retired agency people, people who had worked as range conservationists and biologists for the Forest Service and the Bureau of Land Management. And I thought, wouldn't it be great if I could do videotaped interviews with these people and then put these on the internet so that everybody could have the benefit of seeing these people talk about these issues just the way that I had had the opportunity to actually go to the West and talk with them personally. And so I then got some video equipment, and the following year, in 2003, I set out and started doing these interviews. Well, I did that for about 2 months and then came back here and I started looking at the videotapes, and I thought, well, yeah, I can get some videos out of this, but there's a lot of information from these interviews that didn't seem really suitable to put out on the internet as short videos. And I thought, well, I could actually edit this information into a kind of an oral history, kind of the sort of thing that Studs Terkel has done in his many books over the last 40 years or so. And so that's really how the book itself came to be. I do have, I think, 27 videos out on my website also at this time, and I'll probably get a few more done up in the next few months.
So folks still can go to MikeHudak.com and play these interviews?
That's right.
Oh, great.
You've got another website as well, don't you, related to the book, Mike?
Yeah, there's two websites. There's the book's website, WesternTurfWars.com, and then my own personal website, MikeHudak.com.
Okay, the stories presented in Western Turf Wars suggest that the public lands are not only badly managed out west here, but that the condition of the lands is poor and continuing to degrade. Do you think that this is a fairly accurate portrayal of the agencies and the lands that they manage?
Yeah, I do, and I'll tell you why. The people that I interviewed in this book, at least the government people, all had pretty long careers. They had been with these agencies anywhere from about 16 years to 33 years or so. And these people also, even though some of them were very critical of ranching, had nevertheless grown up with it in one way or another. And I'll just give you a couple of examples. Bill Worf, who was a Forest Service supervisor, grew up on a Montana ranch. Larry Walker, who was a BLM range conservationist, talked of spending summers as a child on a ranch belonging to a close relative in northern New Mexico. And then there was Jim Prunty from Idaho, who was a former Forest Service fire specialist. And Jim not only grew up on a ranch, but actually worked as a cowboy until he was about 40 years of age. So in talking with these people, I didn't get the sense that they had any animosity towards ranching or ranchers as a result of these early experiences. And what criticism they had really stemmed from their experiences in the agencies with the rancher influence that resulted in what they viewed as bad management decisions, and also decisions that ran counter to their own professional training of what constituted good land management. So I think these people that I interviewed have a lot of credibility. And then there's a lot of corroborating evidence that the lands are in generally bad condition. I'll give you a couple statistics that I quote in my book. One of them is that 64% of Forest Service rangelands and 78% of BLM rangelands are described as fair, poor, or of unknown condition. And what fair and poor mean is that the land contains less than 51% of the expected native plant species of a healthy ecosystem. So you already get the idea there's a lot of degradation there. And then another indicator that this damage really is widespread and is not just some local problems that these particular people were talking about is look at the lawsuits that have been brought against the agencies over the last 10 or 15 years. And I looked at the website of the Center for Biological Diversity recently, and they claim a 90% success rate in the courts on a couple hundred lawsuits over the past 15 years dealing mostly with endangered species. Now, I don't know that all of those lawsuits were directly related to grazing. Some may have also been the result of logging impacts, but I suspect that most of those were dealing with grazing impacts. And we have other organizations, too, like Forest Guardians, as I mentioned, and Western Watersheds Project, that also have very high success rates in bringing lawsuits, typically under the Endangered Species Act, that are the result of grazing impacts. And so I would say all of that together gives a pretty clear picture that there are some real problems out on the public lands as a result of long-term grazing.
Mike, let me just ask you something. What does the rancher pay the government to put his cattle out on the land? The amount of money that they pay the government, does that come anywhere close to compensating for the damage done to the land?
The first part, in terms of what they're paying right now, I believe it's $1.35 per cow, calf, pair per month. And that amount of compensation varies every year. It's set every year beginning in March, I believe. And in the last few years, it's varied. I think it's been up as high as $1.56 per cow, calf, pair. But right now, it's down to the mandated minimum. It can't go below this amount, and that's $1.35. And no, it's nowhere near the cost of what it takes to maintain the cattle there. Estimates that I've seen have put that number at least 10 times what the rancher actually pays. And the agencies admit that they're losing money on this. I think there was a GAO report that came out a couple of years ago that did a economic analysis on this. And it found that the government was losing something like $120 million a year on the grazing program. But, you know, they'll say, well, we're not running this program to make money. We're in part running this program to maintain rural economies, for instance. I think that doesn't make as much sense now as it might have made 60 or 70 years ago. And, in fact, there's been economic analysis that I'm familiar with by the economist Tom Power, who has looked at the contribution of ranching to local economies. And west-wide, it's certainly very small. The numbers that I've seen were something like from public lands ranching in the 11 western states, the contribution to jobs is something like 0.07%, and for the income, something like 0.04%.
Wow.
And he even did that analysis down to the county level in some locations in New Mexico and I think Oregon, and even showed that on a county-by-county basis that the contribution from public lands ranching wasn't all that great.
In your book, it's largely interviews of agency personnel from the BLM, Forest Service, and even the Park Service. Those agency personnel that you interviewed, have they paid a price or are they paying a price either professionally or personally for expressing their views to you on the record?
They were already retired, except for one person. And that one person who was still working for the Forest Service was Patrick Ward. He actually did lose his job about a year after we did the interview, but not as a result of doing the interview. He'd actually been working as a contract employee for 16 years, and there came a point where they just said, well, sorry, we don't have any more money to continue your position. But on the other hand, I have to be a little suspicious about that because the research that he talked about that he was doing in regard to the impacts of grazing on habitat of the Mexican spotted owl, the types of findings that he was discovering there were things that indicated that the current level of grazing was not sustainable and that it had to be reduced or eliminated. And so I'm suspicious that he was gotten rid of because the agency and, of course, the ranchers didn't like the conclusions that he was coming to.
I'm also suspicious. Mike, we've only got about 3 minutes left, unfortunately.
Oh, okay.
And I was wondering, since you quote a lot of people in the book, is there a favorite quote that you'd like to relate to our listeners before we sum it up?
Yeah, at the end of an interview that I did with Julian Hatch, who was a grassroots activist in southern Utah, and this is a very interesting guy, descended from Mormon sheep ranchers, moved to southern Utah because he really wanted to live a subsistence lifestyle, had no intention of becoming a grassroots activist. It's just that the cattle in the area trespassed on his land, and he saw all the degraded land on the Grand Staircase. And he's speaking here after having lived there for about 20 years, and he says, "I am the only person that I know that's a pro-environmental advocate who's lasted the last 20 years here. There are a couple other people who have been here that long, but they've become pro-grazing. They've got their own horses. They believe in the grazing principle. They've become outfitters to try to make their living. There have been other environmentalists. The Southern Utah Wilderness Alliance began in this town. There's three founders. Two of them are gone. They didn't last very long. You don't last very long when you get knives stuck in your face, and you get your car's windows smashed in, and you get threats. And if you have loved ones or family, they won't want to live here. You can't send your kids to school here. They will be destroyed. There are a lot of pro-environmental people who come to the area. They visit, they make maps, they do studies, and then they leave. A lot of people are working on this area. It's not like they don't care about it, but very few people dare live here, and I don't blame them. I hate to be very negative about it, but it's the truth. And people need to understand, if you want to fight the grazing, you need to think twice. Maybe you better just go for a hike and look at the cow pies and walk past them. That's if you want to take care of your personal life. If you've got family, you better do that. Maybe just don't go hiking out there at all. Maybe just stay home and see the pictures on the computer of the Grand Staircase. The younger generation, that seems to make them happy. But a person like myself, I'm stuck here. I made my life here, and I'm going to be here probably until I die. I will continue to complain, and I will continue trying to make changes. But I have no illusions about this. The government's out to get you. If you make complaints, you're making their life miserable. They just want to go to work, collect their check, and go home. You're making trouble when you bring up problems about grazing or monitoring or anything else out there. So that's the reality. But like I say, some of us are committed to do it. We'll keep trying to do what we can.
All right, Mike. Thanks very much. We're out of time, and we were speaking with Mike Hudak, who is the author of Western Turf Wars, The Politics of Public Lands Ranching. And you can go to his site, www.westernturfwars.com, to learn about how to purchase this book. Thanks very much, Mike.